Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with Dr. Donald Spencer, VP and Chief Medical Informatics Officer at the UNC Healthcare System, about information technology, or IT, in healthcare, a brave new world.
Yeah, some might call it a brave new world. Some people might say it's a pit that we've run off of, or a cliff. There's lots of metaphors here.
Lots of metaphors.
A brave new world is a positive spin. And Dr. Spencer is one of really, I think, a national leader here. And I'm really looking forward to a conversation with him.
I am too. But first, we have some research that matters. Adam, we're going to talk about whether people would rather get shocked or sit alone with their thoughts, about hand washing in anesthesiologists and a link with infections,
about kids and whether or not they're going to lose out if they're way too geared up.
And finally, about teens being drawn to heavily advertised brands of alcohol. First, we're going to talk about this study about electric shocks. And this was a study that was published in the journal Science, where they asked participants to sit by themselves for 6 to 15 minutes in a room and had the opportunity to give themselves shocks.
Yeah, it sounds like one of these research studies that I'm glad I didn't review. I'm not sure I would have funded it. But it was funded and done, and it was in a prominent journal, Science, so it must be really good research. I think a lot of the participants were probably college students, though.
I wonder. But in this case, 67% of the male participants in one study gave themselves at least one shock during the thinking period. So they would rather give themselves a shock than sit there and just think for that period of time. Women were less likely to shock themselves, with only 25% of the people who shocked themselves during the waiting period.
That's shocking.
That is shocking.
Women have a little more common sense than the men. The men were more likely to give themselves shocks 1.5 times over a 15-minute interval, rather than just sit there and just kind of be quiet and close your eyes and meditate. It's like, what should I do? I'm going to think about life and all my blessings in life, or I'm going to shock myself because I'm bored.
I know. It's interesting. One of the people who reviewed it were speculating that people might prefer to be doing something rather than doing nothing, and sitting alone with your thoughts just felt like doing nothing. And yet, many of us in these busy, hectic lives feel like we'd love, I mean, that sounds wonderful to me if I had 6 to 15 minutes to be alone with myself.
It'll be a little bit later, Christy. A little bit later, like
sleeping.
After you're another 20 years when your kids are out.
Oh, no. Yeah.
But I think one of the things they could have said is, okay, let's put them in a room, give them no directions, let them do them, shock themselves, or say, how about take 15 slow, deep breaths in through your nose and out through your mouth.
Maybe that would be different because that was something active.
Yeah.
Or like, write in a journal
with
your thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyhow, this is interesting research, but Christy and I are not going to be shocking ourselves. I can promise you that.
No, we're not.
We're going to take advantage of that time. We'll take a nap.
Let's talk about a study looking at hand washing. So we all know how important it is to wash your hands and how very important it is for physicians and surgeons and people in an operating room to wash their hands.
So this was in the American Journal of Infection Control, and it was looking at anesthesiologists, the people who are really there making sure everything goes okay during the surgery, and are they washing their hands like the guidelines say they should? Interesting research question.
And what they found was that the anesthesiologists were least likely to properly clean their hands during the first 20 minutes and the last 20 minutes of patient anesthesia, which happened to correspond with increases in when certain touched objects were touched and contaminated with bacteria during those same periods of time.
Yeah, so these anesthesiologists are supposed to, according to guidelines, to wash hands before touching a patient, before a clean procedure, after exposure to any body fluids, after touching a patient, and after touching a patient's surroundings. These would be the same things that Christy and I should be washing our hands. That's a lot of hand washing. And unfortunately, in this particular study, they found that the anesthesiologists were least likely to wash their hands right before patient contact and after contact with the patient's surroundings. This is worrisome because it can increase infection rates. So I think we need to have protocols that help us do what we know needs to be done.
It's true. We were just talking, I don't know, last week or a couple weeks ago about how much we wash our hands and how dry they get and all of this. But yet, study after study shows that doctors and nurses and medical personnel don't do a good enough job. So if you're a patient, pay attention. In this case, you can't pay attention when you're asleep in surgery, but you want to ask your loved ones and yourself when you're in the doctor's office to make sure you remind your doctors gently to wash their hands.
You're going to be meeting with the anesthesiologist before surgery.
That's true.
This is an opportunity to say, how often do you wash your hands?
I'm sure
you wash it four or five times and, you know, remind the anesthesiologist, and I bet they'll do it a lot better.
I bet they will. Let's talk about kids on tight schedules. So we know that, or certainly I know as a parent of young children, that there's a lot of pressure to keep your kids busy and on a regimen and involved in lots of sports and on their way to the Olympics or whatever high-level performance they're going to do.
A contract. They're getting a signed contract.
That's right.
We got to have income here.
That's right. But this is a study looking at 6-year-old children and their parents and having them track what the schedule is like during a period of time, and then doing some studies on the children about their executive function or their ability to plan and solve problems and make decisions that regulate their thoughts and actions.
Yeah, and they classified these children's time as whether they were doing really structured or unstructured activities. Were they involved in things like lessons and sports versus unstructured activities were free play and reading. And then they looked at what they called executive function, how well these kids were able to do on a test. And what I thought was interesting was to ask these children to name as many animals as they could in 1 minute. And those who obviously could name a lot more had higher executive function. And what did they find when they looked at these two things?
So the more time kids had in the less structured activities, the playtime, free time, reading time, the more self-directed they were, and also the more time they spent in structured activities where they were so busy and in their structured activities, the less able they were to use that higher executive function.
So if I want my kids to be able to name more animals in a zoo, I should have less structured time. Is that the take-home message?
I don't know. I think they're trying. This is a, you know, developmental pediatrics and behavioralists are trying to sort out how much of this sort of movement towards all the structure affects children. Brain development and all that. What we don't know is this just a period of time or is this something longstanding? And if you do it differently, does that impact their life in the long run?
And it's not cause and effect here. It could be these kids
that.
Who can name more animals are better just unstructured sorts of folks and don't want to be doing structured time as much. Though I do think there is something into this about, you know, when I was thinking about when I was a kid and being the youngest of five children, I was kind of left, and we were at a dead-end street in the middle of nowhere. I was kind of left alone a lot, really unstructured time. I learned, I think, some skills there, one of which was I better go outside and play and a lot of make-believe play.
What goes back to the other one of being alone with your thoughts or being alone to come up with something to do or to be creative and have creative play is a good thing.
I can name a lot of zoo animals.
I bet you can. You're amazing.
There's a unicorn. are they in zoos anymore? Our last research that matters, Christy.
Okay. Teenagers. Apparently, teenagers are drawn, as we all are, to heavily advertised products, and in this case, heavily advertised alcohol brands.
Yeah, this research was in the Journal of Studies on Alcohol and Drugs, and it looked at young adults and finding, you know, like with many other products that you mentioned, Christy, that the brands that are more heavily advertised, this time and alcohol, that these kids are recognizing them. And this may be, and not unexpectedly, a risk factor for alcohol use.
It can, and it sounds like these brands were more likely to sort of target magazine ads that run and that are most popular in that 18 to 20-year-old age group, and that age group happens to be the ones that are at the highest risk of alcohol abuse and the negative consequences for drinking. So you can't really say that they're targeting that for any sort of malice or anything, but that is a high risk group and the ones that seem to be shaped by and swayed by those ads.
Yeah, it's not surprising. Tobacco advertising is a causal factor in kids smoking. I think it goes without saying alcohol advertising is likely to have the same kind of impact. And we have to start efforts at younger ages. We can't wait till they're 18 or 20. We got to start media literacy at a younger age.
We do. We do. Well, we've had a chance to talk a little bit to alcohol brands and advertising for teens.
About why I am the way I am, because I was left outside alone so often.
Okay. About anesthesiologists and other medical professionals failing to wash hands.
And about the shocking finding when particularly adult males are left alone to shock themselves.
Okay, that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Donald Spencer, VP and Chief Medical Informatics Officer at the UNC Healthcare System, about IT, or Information Technology in Healthcare, a brave new world. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Donald Spencer, Vice President and Chief Medical Informatics Officer at the University of North Carolina Healthcare System, about IT in healthcare, a brave new world.
Welcome, Dr. Spencer.
Thank you.
And we should also mention, you are also a faculty member and a family medicine doctor in the UNC Department of Family Medicine. We wouldn't want to leave that out.
Thank you for saying that, because after all, I'm a partner of you two. So it's very exciting to be here interviewed for the show.
Yeah, well, we're glad to have you. You know, I happen to know that you were practicing in a rural area early in your career, and just like a regular family doctor became involved in teaching. How did your career, or what is it that has drawn you to become so passionate and a leader in the area of information technology?
Well, it's true. I started out in a small North Carolina town in Anson County, North Carolina, 300 people, and it was very small. We, at the time, were writing notes and sending our bills by hand and licking stamps to send them out, so it was a whole nother era back then, 37 years ago when I started out. But, you know, I think I was drawn to technology out of necessity. We needed to do things with our practice management system. As time went on, I was the person that got on all the computer committees because nobody wanted to do it. And of course, the fact that my father, my brother, my uncles are all engineers might have something to do with it.
So this is you're blaming it on your genes.
I think it is genetic, yes.
Well, you know, when we think about information technology, I remember quite vividly the paper charts that we did up until the 1990s or early 1990s that University of North Carolina, probably around the country and probably at some places still. What drove the very first innovations or the desire that paper charts, you know, what was wrong with them?
Well, it is interesting. I remember, Adam, when I came to University of North Carolina in the 1990s, our patients were complicated. They went not only to us as family doctors, but they went to the cardiologist and the rheumatologist and the nephrologist and the ologist. And the charts were so thick for some of my patients that they did not even fit in the bin of the chart bin on the door.
Volume 4 fit.
That's about it. And if the patient had been down the street even to see the neurosurgeon, you wouldn't actually have the chart because it might have been in transit there for that patient. So you were left sometimes what we'd call flying blind, where you didn't have the information you needed to take care of the patient.
And so how has this development of the electronic health record, and we should probably define that for our listeners, but how has that really made a difference in moving towards better care?
Well, it's true. You know, I guess the best term now is electronic health record rather than electronic medical record, because the intent is really to keep people healthy. It's not just to take care of their diseases, but it's to prevent diseases. And when I got started with computers and medicine. It really was, as I was saying before, to send out the bills and do the practice management aspects of your practice. But now it's medical information to keep patients healthy. And over time, that technology has gotten better and better, and not just for physicians and nurses and respiratory therapists, but now we're turning the corner and the technology is available for patients themselves.
So it seems like one of the drivers of this is the technological innovation, the changes in society, not just in medicine, but across all industries. So you think about banking and the ability to, you know, banks used to be only open, you know, 8 to 4 Monday through Friday, and then now you can have the universal banking. But in healthcare, it seems like when the patient, you couldn't access their record, you would have talked with them, right? You would have said, I'll find out, I'll do what you need. What kind of problems existed up until recently and maybe still exist in some places that rely on these records? Because I think a lot of people would say, well, the care was still good. What were the problems?
Yeah, I think that with something as complicated as healthcare, there are things that happen in various settings and we don't know about them as physicians. I'll give you an example that I just recently heard about. We just instituted a new electronic health record system in our healthcare system, UNC Healthcare, and this was just 3 months ago. Well, one of our families was vacationing in California, in Palo Alto, California, and they took their 3-month-old baby to Stanford University Hospital, the children's hospital there. And it just so happens that Stanford went on the same electronic health record 2 months ago. So here comes a little baby into the Stanford University Hospital, and the doctor gets information, of course, from the parents. But there are tests that were done, somewhat complicated genetic tests that were done here at University of North Carolina that the doctor had no insight into. So he got on the computer and logged into our system securely and found out this information. He was so amazed by it that he sent us an email about how this really helped the care of his little 3-month-old patient.
And whereas in the old days, that doctor would have had to have called UNC or perhaps repeated some of those tests, or how would it have been? How would he have cared for that baby?
Right. We certainly would have been able, even 4 months ago, sent him a fax, but it would take calling us, finding out who to call, which is a big thing in a complicated bureaucracy, as academic healthcare systems sometimes are known to be. I mean, it wouldn't have been Pony Express. We could have gotten it there faster than mailing it, but still, it would have not taken the minutes it took with the electronic health record that he had at Stanford. It would have taken days.
Yeah, I had a patient not too dissimilar the other day, Dr. Spencer, that came in to see me and said they had a study at a hospital in North Carolina, and to make sure they didn't have a clot. And I thought, well, they probably meant they didn't have a clot from their veins, but I was actually worried about a clot from the artery. And the question was, did their study look at just the veins or was the arteries? And there was just no way I was going to be able to do this in real time, but yet I had to make a decision. So did I repeat a test that didn't need to be done or not? And it just so happened they have the exact same system like Stanford that UNC adopted, and I was able to actually look in and figure this out within about 2 minutes, which to me was just like, you know, I was willing to smile, and if you'd asked for a check right then, I may have given it to you.
Yeah, you're right, Adam. And the interesting thing to me is that it doesn't matter if it's a hospital 10 miles away, like Duke University Hospital. I had a patient who had surgery at Duke recently, and it was my patient as the primary care physician. 10 miles or the 2,800 miles to Stanford, it really doesn't make any difference as far as time anymore. It's just as efficient and effective.
So coordination of care, collaboration of care, these things seem like a given. They're better. Is that the case?
Yeah, I think it is. And part of what we should, I think, be happy about is that the technology is not just about the bits and the bytes, but it's about standards so that we can specify ways to get information across to hospitals in different parts of the countries that may have different electronic records.
We're going to talk about lots of these issues But we're going to need to take a short break. When we return, we're going to continue talking with our great guest, Dr. Donald Spencer, Vice President, Chief Medical Information Officer at the University of North Carolina Healthcare System, about IT in healthcare, Brave New World. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Donald Spencer, Vice President and Chief Medical Informatics Officer at the University of North Carolina Healthcare System, about IT in healthcare, a brave new world. And before the break, Dr. Spencer, we were talking about some of the benefits to the patient of having these electronic health records with communication and making appointments online. But I also wonder about that doctor-patient relationship in the exam room. I know my patients are able to access me easier. I can get their results to them faster. But it's somewhere time's attention to get into the computer and do all the things I need to do and also maintain focus on what the patient is saying. What do we know about how this impacts that relationship?
Well, Christy, I think like any other tool, you can use the tool correctly and incorrectly, and it takes some time to learn how to use it. When people ask me that question, I kind of go back to the analogy of a stethoscope. Now, a stethoscope was invented by René Laennec in 1812, I think, and it was just a hollow tube, and you put it on a patient's back, and sometimes I would imagine back then they turned it around backwards and used the wrong end to put it on there, and it took about 50 years before they developed the flexible tube for the stethoscope so that we would know what we would recognize it as a stethoscope back about 50 years. And my stethoscope that I use today was actually created in the 1940s, the Sprague Rapoport. And now cardiologists use electronic stethoscopes. So it takes a long time to figure out how to use new technology. And with health IT, you can use it incorrectly as well as correctly.
Well, we know what to get you for your birthday, Dr. Spencer,
a
new stethoscope, one that's made in the last four decades. But I guess a question that I'd have for you is, what are some of the problems that you see with the current state-of-the-art IT information technology that we are using around the country? What are some of the problems that need to be dealt with?
Well, you know, I think the most obvious one is not so much the technology, but it's how you use the technology. So I can take a laptop into a room and have my put the laptop on the table and have my back to the patient.
And right, because the table wasn't designed.
It was
that
not
way.
Designed for a computer between you and the patient. And when you're kind of overwhelmed with the information and the technology, I've seen a lot of physicians do that. But on the positive side, if you bring that computer in the room and make it part of your visit, so you can point to things on the computer screen and the patient can see it, and you can point and you can see things yourself, you can make it part of the visit. But it takes practice. It's not easy.
And what about this idea that the time that it takes? Because one of the concerns I've also heard expressed is not just the patients love it, but the providers. They're worried because it takes more time, and that part of it is information overload. You're given the entire street address for all of North Carolina, but all you really need to know is where's Raleigh.
That's right. I mean, and I think this is another, there's no doubt that initially when you get started, computerized health records take more time for you as a clinician. There's a big learning curve on there. In fact, the first experiments at the University of Virginia computerized physician order entry in the 1990s, the resident physicians revolted and said, this is taking too much time. We're just going to kind of get around the system. So what happened, they invented something where they could bunch orders together and you could write an order set with several orders. time is important. But the other thing, Adam, I think you have to look at is the totality of the time, not just the time in the exam room. But, you know, before I'd go home and dictate for an hour on my dictaphone. I would spend hours on hold with the pharmacy. Now I can, with the press of a button, send a prescription electronically to any pharmacy in the Chapel Hill, Durham area, or even to California in that case.
Well, you mentioned something about quality and best practices earlier, and I want to get in a little bit about how having an electronic health record can really help us improve our quality of care for patients. We all are trying our very best in that one-on-one encounter to do everything we're supposed to do for our patients, and yet we've learned that we don't do as well unless we have good reminders. How will this change and improve, or what do we know about how they improve quality of care for patients?
Well, I think it's taught us that medicine is really a team sport. I think decades and decades ago, we thought that it all resided on the shoulders of the physician, and that's just not true. In fact, in our office, we've found that the most effective way for patients to get flu shots in the fall is to take it out of the hands of the physicians, put a standing order in the hands of the nursing staff, and all of a sudden, patients got a lot more flu shots. And you can do this a lot more with electronic records when you develop standing protocols that everyone agrees on. But it takes human communication amongst the providers to decide what you want to do, and then you can automate them and get them implemented with the electronic record a lot quicker and more consistently.
You know, one of the challenges, I think, for a lot of our colleagues that are perhaps in smaller practices is the cost of going to electronic health record. And we know that the federal government through the Affordable Care Act has not only kind of pushed, sometimes even requiring basically other penalties, the cost for UNC Healthcare and many major academic health centers has to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars to do these types of innovations. This tension pull between our colleagues who may be in smaller practices, how can they afford it? What are the options? What do you do?
Yeah, the cost is always a complicated issue. But I can tell you that healthcare systems are growing. You know, UNC Healthcare System, Duke Healthcare Systems. If you look at all the healthcare systems around the country, smaller practices seem to be coming to healthcare systems, and they grow. And as they grow, what we found, the situation we found ourselves in, was that we had three different hospitals with three different electronic records. Our healthcare system has since grown to eight different hospitals with all these different electronic records, hundreds of small practices that were part of the UNC healthcare system with different electronic health records. So that inconsistency was very expensive to communicate one record to the next to the next. So as we spend millions of dollars on these record systems, it really is to simplify things. It's to make less interfaces needed between the billing system and the lab system and the pharmacy system and such.
Well, I know we're going to need to start ending our conversation soon, and I want to be sure that our listeners out there have a chance to really think about how the electronic health record at their doctor's office might impact them and what they should know. What would be your recommendations for patients to think about how to take advantage of their record and how to help their doctor use it in a way that improves communication?
Well, I just had a patient this afternoon, and she was not so much into technology. She said our particular health record is by a vendor called Epic, and she said, Dr. Spencer, you do the Epic thing. I'm just not into it. And so we had a talk about how signing up for the patient portal allowed me to get her results quicker, and I promised her that I would still talk to her on the phone. She was worried that the electronic patient portal would keep me from having that personal contact, and I think we have to reassure our patients that it's just to help us with bringing information together, more efficient communication, but particularly as family doctors, we're never going to get that personal touch to go away. That would be something that would be a real dissatisfier for patient and doctor alike.
Well, I must say, we really want to thank you Dr. Don Spencer, who's really a leader in the University of North Carolina system in the country to help bring this brave new world, but have this be patient-centered. The fact that you're a family doctor by training and by heart, I think is reassuring to a lot of our patients. We want to thank you on behalf of your health for providing this expertise.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks, Christy.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend some time talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, you can send your comments or questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first House Call today about someone who's got acne in the beard.
I'm 30 years old. My uncle has acne in his beard. It's really ugly and it looks painful. His doctor told him to let his beard grow out. I don't want to have the same problem, but I also don't want a beard. What should I do?
Goodness gracious, that's a good question and maybe gets us into some areas we haven't talked about before.
Yeah, I wonder if it is truly acne, which is possible, or if it's a form of folliculitis or inflammation or infection or irritation that can happen in those hair follicles where the beard grows.
And we call that pseudofolliculitis Barbie, which is a fancy term for things that look like folliculitis in the hair follicles of the beard area, though it could happen elsewhere, like it could happen in the pubic area, it would be pseudofolliculitis pubis, but in this particular case, it's in the beard area.
Apparently, it's more common in people who have curlier hair, just because that can curl even in the follicle itself, and the treatment is often to grow that beard even longer to give it a chance to stop irritating the skin.
Because shaving frequently is irritating to the skin, and for people who are kind of prone to this, particularly with people with really curly hair, sometimes that shaving can cause this inflammation, and then you have these hairs that tend to want to be curly and curl back into the skin, or even curl before they come, the follicles curl before they come out of the skin. So you can treat it like you do acne, but more importantly, for a lot of people, it is having a beard. Now, whether you'll have it because your uncle has it, yeah. Not a given.
If you don't want a beard, I wouldn't grow one just to prevent having this. I would just wait. And if you have that trouble, try growing a beard and seeing if it makes a difference.
Yeah. If you're like me, you couldn't grow a beard if you tried. Good luck. Thank you for the question. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I heard your show recently on mammograms and the study from Canada. I've gotten mammograms regularly without a problem for 10 years. And when I asked my OBGYN, she said I should continue. I'm confused. Any thoughts?
Well, you're not alone.
Welcome to our world.
Exactly. It is very confusing with the different conflicting studies and large studies that we have to look at right now and to weigh. I think if you're currently in the United States, the guidelines from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force would recommend that if you're over the age of 50, that doing a mammogram every other year is advisable.
And I think one of the only questions our expert from Canada raises is that the science will sometimes outpace the guidelines. And so if the guidelines are changing or if they were to change, and I think this is the hard part, it's easy to say yes here. And that becomes then a very simple conversation where the reality of our conversations are they're much more difficult and it involves some of your values and mm-hmm. then telling you about the data. Because if someone says, well, it doesn't help you and it could hurt you, do you want to have it? And these are long conversations. So to be honest, I think you're going to have a longer conversation and then make some decisions for yourself. It may be right for you to have it, but it may be right for you not to.
It's so confusing. We're sorry that you're sort of left confused by it. As soon as we get more clarity and as there are more debates that go on, we'll be raising this issue continually on the show.
But your values are important. Thank you for sharing them. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I brought my daughter in for a checkup and shots. I told the doctor about several problems she's been having, like abdominal pain, fatigue after eating, and a few other things. The doctor was very thorough to explore everything and explained that this was both a physical and a regular visit in one day. This means I had to pay $20 copay since well child checks are free. Does this sound right to you?
Well, it does sound right to me, to be honest with you, that a lot of people, children and adults, have problems when they come in for their well child or well male or well female visit that aren't just about prevention. They're having a lot of issues that are happening with them, and they want to talk with their doctor while they're there about those issues, and that's important.
And so it's a pretty standard practice for doctors if you're doing sort of a problem-based visit where you've got multiple things that you're exploring and investigating, and you're also doing a preventive visit to build that in a way, and most of the electronic health records would capture it in a way that would capture both of those types of visits in one day. In this case, it sounds like your doctor might not have known that you were trying to put all this into your preventive visit so that you didn't have a copay, and there may have been a miscommunication or something around that. Maybe it would have been helpful to have that conversation at the beginning of the visit so that you could proceed instead of at the end.
Yeah, and I think it's important to know that really in any field, if you're paying for something that's a preventive care and you discover a problem, like you having someone come by and power wash your house and you discover that there is rotten wood, you're going to expect have that rotten wood fixed. And I think in our healthcare system, we have to understand that time is really important and expertise is important. But I think you're right, Christy. We probably need to tell people this in advance because it is very confusing, even for us.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. It's a sensitive topic, and I would just encourage you to always bring that information at the very beginning to be sure you know what you're getting into.
But I'm glad that you did, and you're bringing it up because it sounds like your child needed to be brought up
yeah.
and had some issues. So, Erica, what's our very last house call?
My 80-year-old father was just diagnosed with coronary artery disease and atrial fibrillation. He's feeling better, but I'm worried. Does that sound serious enough for me to travel to be with him? It requires me to leave my children and family, so I'm trying to weigh out the need.
Well, that's complex.
We're going to have a no-win situation here, Christy.
I know.
Well, first off, I would say it depends. How's that for a definitive answer? Like, how far away do you live? Like, we have some friends whose parents are in Seattle and coming from Chapel Hill to Seattle. That's a long way.
Right. And also depends on some family dynamics and expectations that you've set and that your parents have set with you and what they need, and some open and honest communication from you, between you and your father, about what does he need. As if he needs that support, then it may be worth all of the effort to leave your family and arrange all that. But if he really feels like he's fine, then I can see why you might not go for this particular instance.
I think if you're thinking about it in general, I would lean towards doing it, because I don't think you can really know for certain. You could talk with their doctor, but if it's possible to do and financially it's not bad, I think it's a good thing in general.
And I think
as I get older.
It also raises an opportunity for you to really communicate with them and think about if they need more care and they need more attention, maybe there's an opportunity for them to move closer, or for you to figure out if you have siblings who's kind of on first call to help be that in that supportive role.
And do they have their advanced directives and meet their doctor? Lots of good things. Well, we want to thank you for that question and thank all of our listeners today for some excellent house calls. And we want to thank you for joining us today on Your Health.
We want you to share your questions, share your stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and get our health app by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download at the App Store.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guest today, Dr. Donald Spencer. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.